From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Shana Stulen, Washington and Foreign Affairs correspondent. Joining me on the panel via Skype are Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today and Dow Jones Market Watch. Also joining us, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The U.S. reopens. We'll look at how each state is reopening and how President Trump is weighing in. The president lashing out at Twitter after Twitter fact-checks his tweets on alleged voter fraud. Plus, presidential conventions. What could those political mega events look like in a time of social distancing? And a global view of the pandemic, where the new hotspot is and what leaders there are doing about it. And anger and outrage in Minneapolis after the death of an unarmed Black man in police custody. Paul, Michael, so good to talk to both of you. Obviously, we're all doing this remotely because of social distancing. And before we jump into how the country is reopening and the politics around it, this country has now reached a grim milestone. 100,000 people have now died from the coronavirus, and that number is only rising. And Paul, this number is staggering. It's only happened in 4 months. And unlike 9/11 or natural disasters, the U.S. hasn't had a moment to come together as a nation to grieve. What does it mean for the country not to be able to mourn together?
Well, that's such a good point. The fact that we have not had that moment makes all of this worse. Of course, I think there's one big difference between now and 2001. Boy, it seems like yesterday, but it was nearly 20 years ago. Hard to believe. That really was a moment that really did bring the country together, at least for a while. I think the sad thing about the situation now is that in some ways it has really driven us further apart. We're arguing over social distancing and whether people should wear masks. And we argue about this in political terms. I think the health debate over wearing a mask and staying 6 feet away from people, I think that is undebatable. I think there are clearly health benefits to that. And yet some people seem to see it in political terms. If you wear a mask, somehow that is a slap against President Trump. The irony here is that the Centers for Disease Control, which of course is a part of the U.S. government, are the ones who are saying you should wear a mask. It reduces the possibilities of getting COVID-19. I think they say by about 75%. So if 9/11 brought us together, I think tragically this in some ways is now kind of dividing us. And that's, to me, I think very, very troubling.
Yeah, and really just adds to the whole sort of unease about this whole situation. And Michael, to Paul's point about masks, we are being told not only by the CDC, but by health officials that the administration is putting out there to talk to the American public, Dr. Birx, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Hahn of the FDA, wear masks. There's science that backs up wearing masks and slowing the virus, but the president won't wear a mask publicly. What kind of message do you think that sends to Americans?
Well, it certainly sends a message that the president will do as he will. He's never really left election mode from his win. He won the presidency and has never really left election mode. And everything that he does, everything that he says is calibrated on what his perceived electorate will respond to. And he believes that this doesn't send a message of strength. It doesn't send a message of somehow even freedom or autonomy, things that are completely disassociated with the science related to wearing a mask. It also sends a message that I think Paul alluded to it, that there is a disconnect between the scientists that are in the administration and the political people that are in the administration. You have these states that are reopening despite a mandate or a recommendation, a strong recommendation by the Center for Disease Control that states not open up until they've had 14 days of a downward trajectory in the number of cases, number of fatalities, and not one single state that's reopening has come even close to meeting those criteria. It's a message that is disjointed. It's a message that is somehow contradictory and I think ultimately ineffective. Because if the president really wants the country to open up, and of course he does, and of course everybody does, we want to return to, not return to normal, but find the new normal and advance along that path. Safety and confidence in going out and being out is paramount to that situation. So wearing a mask, social distancing are the logical steps in doing that. And yet somehow people have taken it upon themselves to think that we won't do that. And that is going to advance the case for opening sooner or more effectively, which is just flat out wrong.
The president is spending his time on Twitter, as we know, that's his favorite sort of platform to get his message out. And he really has used Twitter to his advantage because he can say anything he wants without any pushback. It's not as if he's at a press briefing where reporters are asking questions at him. But our next topic I want to touch on is this fight now between President Trump and the social media giant. What happened was he has been tweeting about alleged voter fraud, misinformation about alleged voter fraud, and Twitter for the first time ever has now fact-checked the president on this issue particularly. Can you give us some of the background here, Michael? What was the president alleging, and why did Twitter finally step in?
Before I do that, I just want to get one more point in on the last topic, which is about the president's role as a comforter. And I just wanted to say that the president there is, he is more comfortable as a cheerleader in chief. And he said that himself, I want to be a cheerleader for the country. And I think that the real problem there is he only wants to be a cheerleader and send the message to between 35 and 45% of the country. He's only interested in providing comfort and a buoyant spirit to those who are predisposed to believe whatever he might say. So yeah, comforter, not going to happen. Salesman, which is what he is by nature, he does have some of that, but none of that is particularly effective in a situation like this. Going to the Twitter issue, President Trump, as you have said, he has used Twitter to his advantage even well before his political aspirations, has used Twitter to spread, I think, his original falsehood, which is the scandal or the theory that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. He's somehow a foreign national, and that served greatly to advance his political career. He has recently taken to reviving a completely debunked, slanderous lie about a GOP politician turned TV broadcaster who is a Trump critic. This guy, Joe Scarborough, was alleged to have somehow been complicit in the death of an employee of his, and his family, the coroner's report, everything points that it was an accident. It was a medical situation. And he's reviving this and suggesting somehow that there was foul play done. In addition to that, he has started doing these tweets about, making these tweets about voter mail-in, how it's a fraud, how it is a way for the Democratic Party to somehow engage in massive fraud. And I think this is a strategy to set up a case that the election is rigged if it so happens that he loses in November, planting the seeds that somehow all 50 states have combined to rig the election against him, even those states where you have the Republican Party, his own party, completely in charge of the voting apparatus. Twitter, as an organization, did not choose to pull down the Joe Scarborough, the journalist tweets, but they did choose to flag something called like a warning, like a health warning, saying that these tweets may not be true. And they fact checked them, which made the president go absolutely ballistic because he does count on this platform. And he has threatened to take action with an executive order against Twitter and other social media platforms, claiming that they are biased somehow against conservative commentators. We don't know yet what that executive order is going to say, what it's going to do. And I haven't heard anything about what the president actually has the power to do. But it just really exacerbates the situation where the president sort of governs by Twitter. And he himself acknowledges that this is his platform more than any other. And if he's not allowed to say anything and everything that he wants to say, it does somehow diminish his ability to reach his public with these messages, whether they be truthful or not.
Paul, and to Michael's point where Twitter flagged these tweets about voter fraud and not about Joe Scarborough, it does seem like Twitter is picking and choosing here.
Well, first of all, when the president says that he is being censored, that he can't speak freely on this platform, that certainly is not true. It's ironic that he says he's being muzzled when he's using Twitter to say he's being muzzled, and he has an audience of some 80 million followers, so he's hardly being muzzled here. All Twitter is doing is, first of all, they are allowing him to speak freely. He can say and tweet whatever he wants, no matter how outrageous it is. All they're doing is what a lot of newspapers and a lot of cable news channels in the United States do, which is point out things he's saying that don't correspond with the facts. What's wrong with fact-checking and telling people what the facts really are? There's a solution to this. If the president is unhappy about being fact-checked, he could try telling the truth rather than just presuming he can spew out, and let's be honest, what he's doing here, he's spewing out accusations of murder. And in the past, he's talked about kind of a weird medical remedies for COVID-19, these kind of things, just to thinking that whatever he says will go out free and unfettered into the Twitterverse, if you will. There's nothing wrong with adding a fact check to that. I think the American people deserve facts and the truth. So I say, tell the truth, tell the facts, and let the chips fall where they may. And if he has a problem with that, then it says a lot more about him than I think it does about Twitter.
I want to ask one more question about this, but we're coming up to a break. So let's have the break and we'll continue this conversation on the other side. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on VOA's website at voanews.com. Now back to our panel via Skype, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today and Dow Jones Market Watch, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. Michael, I want to pick up on this conversation we're having about the president versus Twitter, where Twitter has now for the first time started to fact check the president's tweet and the president accusing the social media giant of censoring him. I mean, Facebook has come out and said they're not going to do something similar, that they should not be the arbiter of truth. And you do have, it's not only the president, you do have conservative groups who have long complained that social media companies have censored conservatives. I do imagine conservatives are watching what happens with Twitter to see if they don't only fact check the president, but that they're fear across the board and will fact check Democrats who may tweet out misinformation or things that are not true.
Well, I don't think that anybody is really against anyone being fact-checked who is putting information out there that is not only dishonest, but personally damaging. I mean, when you think about a sitting president of the United States accusing a political rival of murder and suggesting that there is some sort of cold case out there that needs to be investigated, especially given the situation with its own Department of Justice, which is being highly politicized. This is something we never thought that we would come across. So this is not just a fact of maybe getting a number wrong by a few hundred or a few thousand or a few million even, as the president is known to do. This is something where not only is an individual being accused of something, there is a family that has suffered a loss and has begged Twitter to do something about this. And they say that their policies haven't been violated. Fine. As long as this is done equally among all parties, I think everyone can say that truth is best. Are conservatives unfairly targeted? I don't see any real evidence of that. When you see conservatives that have been censored and even removed from the platform, you have examples like Alex Jones, a conservative commentator, who is suggesting that the murders of the children in Sandy Hook did not occur, that it was false. I mean, some outrageously things that don't even fall, in my mind, into the realm of conservative political discussion. This is just nonsense. They're out there in the circus. So yeah, it depends on how wide you want to stretch that title, that moniker of conservative commentator. If the Republican Party wants to claim people like Alex Jones as part of their group that is being censored, then that's on them. They'll have to take responsibility for that. There is no problem, I think, with anyone saying that Republicans and Democrats, conservatives, liberals, whoever, should be telling the truth and that Twitter should be checking them. And by the way, Twitter, unlike Facebook, does not accept political ads. So I think in comparison of the two, Twitter is a better actor than Facebook on all fronts in this.
And staying with the presidential election, I know that we can barely remember what day of the week it is, but we do happen to be 5 months away from the 2020 election. And part of a presidential election, we always see these giant mega party conventions where each party, thousands of people come out. It's a lot of fanfare where each side chooses their party nominee. The Republican convention is supposed to be in North Carolina in August. And the president has said he wants a packed arena there, but the governor of that state, a Democrat, is not so sure that that is possible in this time of social distancing. Paul, is it possible to have these political conventions during a global pandemic that we're seeing now?
Well, that appears to be what President Trump wants, but you'd have to wonder whether a lot of these Republican delegates and so forth really want to sit directly next to each other in a packed auditorium. I suppose if they believe what the president says, that this pandemic is over — it's clearly not over, by the way — but if they want to believe that it is, then they can take their chances and sit next to each other and breathe next to each other and all of that, and you know, we'll see what happens. I just don't think that is feasible, and we keep hearing that on the Democratic side, that former Vice President Biden, who will be the Democratic nominee, has said, look, this Milwaukee convention in the state of Wisconsin might not be held at all. We might have to do it online. I think we could be seeing, in fact, maybe foreshadowing for what future conventions will be like. I mean, I've been to enough of these conventions. I can tell you that they're kind of outdated. They're highly scripted, made for TV spectacles. They run for 4 nights. Few people watch them anymore. I think there's talk from Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic House Speaker, that, look, you can have the whole thing in one night. You nominate Biden, the vice president, or whoever that will be. He makes a speech online, and everybody says, great, and then they go on their separate ways. The problem, of course, is that it, you know, denies Democrats and perhaps the Republicans a lot of free time on TV to spout whatever their respective party lines are. That's what it's all about. But I think these days, since we're talking about social media, there are all kinds of different ways that candidates and parties can get their message across other than television, which is now kind of a, you know, 60, 70, 80-year-old format.
Yeah, and to what Paul's talking about, Michael, do we even need these conventions anymore? Because, spoiler alert, we know which nominee each party is going to choose. It's not a surprise. It's not these smoke-filled rooms that we had in the past where party leaders would choose the nominee. So what is the point of convention?
There's a reasonable question, and there has been even before the pandemic situation, about what a convention should be, ought to be. That's been discussed everywhere from the White House to episodes of The West Wing about what the conventions ought to be. But in this particular situation, you can hold the general discussion back and just say, what do we do about 2020 and a convention? Look at what the crowd of a convention is. I mean, as an event, it's somewhere, as Paul says, it's somewhere between a sporting event, a circus, and a religious revival. You know, it's just this 4 days of madness, and it's in a crowded room with people from every single state and territory that comprises the United States of America. And if you were to plan a way to spread a pandemic across the United States, effectively, this is what you would do. Let's get somebody from everybody in each state, have them potentially be infected, and send them back to where they came from. It's a preposterous notion when you look at it that way. So I just don't think, given some medical criteria that's met that says, yeah, it's safe, absolutely safe to do something like this, and I don't see anything like that on the horizon. Yeah, possibly. But at this point, how you ask the governor of a state who's responsible for not only the people of his state electorally, but morally responsible for all of his fellow citizens to say, we're definitely going to do something like that in our state. It's a question without an answer. It's like, probably not, but let's rather look at alternatives. But going forward, conventions, maybe. Going forward with a convention in 2020, almost certainly not.
Right. And you have some other governors, though, including the governor of Florida, saying that they'll step in and gladly host the convention in their state. I want to take a step back from U.S. politics for a moment and take a global look at this pandemic. Public health officials are now calling Latin America the epicenter of the outbreak, and Brazil has been particularly hard hit. Paul, what can you tell us about that?
Well, Latin America has surpassed Europe and the United States now in the daily number of these reported infections, and the World Health Organization and others have now put the region at the center of the global outbreak. Brazil, in particular, Brazil is by far the biggest country in Latin America, and it's quite troubling if you look at the data there. It shows that the number of new cases, for example, reported in the last 7 days are by far the highest for that country. I think it has since taken, overtaken Russia to become the country with the most confirmed cases after the United States. I think it's approaching 25,000 deaths. Brazil is quite troubling, but other countries also in South America, I think, also look troubling. Peru and Chile, for example. So I think all of this suggests that things that worked pretty well in other countries like South Korea and Germany, both of them engaged pretty quickly, I think, in extensive testing, contact tracing, and so forth. South American countries really need to ramp up those things too.
Yeah, in fact, he called it, Bolsonaro called it the little flu. Yeah, and as we've heard from other political leaders here in the U.S., also insinuated that it was a media hoax. But the U.S. has gone ahead and imposed a travel ban on Brazil. There are travel bans on China, on Europe, on the U.K. Michael, any sense that we're getting closer to a time when those travel bans might be lifted?
No, I think the pandemic is clearly making its way around the world for the first time, by the way. And I think there will be circuits, you know, in the future that as it spreads, as it mutates, it's going to make its way around the world through populations because things like air travel have made it so easy for something like the virus to do that. As Paul alluded to, you know, we're talking about the service of government and its responsibility to its citizens. I've noticed that COVID-19 exploits pre-existing conditions in individuals, and that's how it makes its nest, and that's how it spreads and does damage. And I think as a society, COVID-19, or as various societies, it also exposes and works insidiously within pre-existing conditions within society. When you have populations that are suffering through inequalities in healthcare and resources, when you have leadership that is more concerned with self-aggrandizement than with the well-being of its citizens, the people that they were elected to take, these pre-existing conditions can be exploited and are being exploited, not to the advantage of the people, but to the advantage of the virus itself. The ability of countries to recover and move forward from this will be based on the adherence and the recognition of science as the sole determining factor for how safety and confidence is achieved, and the integrity of the response by the government to implement those things. And also, I would say, the compliance of the population.
We only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to touch on this story that's sparking a lot of anger and outrage in the U.S. The death of a Black man, an unarmed Black man, in police custody in Minneapolis. We have seen protests break out. Some of those have turned violent. There's video showing a white officer with his knee on the neck of this man, George Floyd, who died shortly after that. Michael, how is the city of Minneapolis responding to what happened here?
The city of Minneapolis is angry. The city of Minneapolis is shocked. As an African American, I was hurt. The range of emotions that goes through you when you see that video and think that that could easily have been me. It could easily have been me. It was a nonviolent crime that this person was accused of committing and ends up essentially being executed in public for God knows what reason. The city is angry. The country is angry. And I talked before about pre-existing conditions, racism, inequality. This is one of them. When you have a police force that is charged with serving and protecting its populace and does the exact opposite, there will be response. I in no way condone any type of violent response to this. I think it's counterproductive. But I do think that people need to understand that when a government and a police force murders its own citizens with impunity, there will be a reaction. And I hope that there is not just a reaction. My hope is for justice in this case. So hopefully the city of Minneapolis will calm itself and allow the process of justice to work. If justice is not found, you're going to see more of the same. And I think maybe not only in Minneapolis in the future.
Yeah, the FBI says, we're being told, is now opening an investigation. The president has weighed in. Clearly a lot of anger out there. Even as the pandemic has taken up so much focus, there are still, as you say, issues in this country that need to be looked at and attention paid. Okay, that is it for us. Thank you so much to Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today and Dow Jones Market Watch, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.